Blog Talk Radio.
Your host. I hope you are in a good place today and ready to join us for another interesting program. It is Saturday, August 2nd. Yes, we are into August already. I can't believe it. The year 2014 for you people that are archiving this show. And welcome. Welcome to a program that each week delves into subjects of the past, ancient past, unknown civilizations, some known, but mostly topics around discoveries from ancient Earth past history. Last week's guest, archaeologist Bill Donato, was not only just fascinating and an eye-opener for me, he has become one of our best-reviewed and largest-downloaded guests since day one. Well, actually, he's only second to John Anthony West, but his program has gone viral on Blog Talk Radio, and he's now, I think, around 2,000 downloads in the last 3-4 days. And his research in the Bimini Islands and the ruins under there is pretty interesting. I have posted a follow-up photograph on the Facebook page of one of the last sonar scans that he did. It was posted, I believe, let's take a look here real quickly. It was posted on the 27th, which was Wednesday. And you want to take a look at it because of two reasons. First, the shadows on these ruins signify not only one on the left or on the bottom of the image. And by the way, it's called Megalis Under the Ocean at Bimini. That's the title. And the one pyramid is so tall, it looks like it's about 250 feet high. The shadow, according to Bill, indicates that it's not only a large pyramid, but it's very well shaped. What's interesting is next to it or above the pyramid is a sphere, some spherical shape object that is very, very tall, about half the size of the pyramid. He says that the reason I posted it, this is the next dive for the Apex Institute, which Bill Donato founded in 2006. They're actually going to go and try to dive. And if they can't dive in wetsuits, they're going to try to get a submarine down there because these are significant structures. And I would love to see more photographs. I told him, we'll have you back on when those when you guys do that dive. I'd be happy to post any additional photographs you have. So take a look at that. It was posted July 27th. Again, it was called Megalis Under the Ocean at Bimini. The last photograph taken in 2006 by the Apex Institute. And it is the most profound evidence of a sunken civilization. And is it evidence of Atlantis? We don't know. Again, listen to last week's program with Bill Donato, the archaeologist who basically has dedicated his life to the study of the lost civilization of Atlantis, and this might be some of the best evidence. Also, on the Facebook page, take a look at the tower at Sacsayhuaman in Peru. I posted some new photographs. The thing that I have great interest in, and one of the areas I'm going to be viewing in September, is the tower area. It's the flat hill, artificially flattened, and the civilization that built the structures built a central tower. And the reason I posted it, and I've known about this for a long time, is the central tower has channels cut into the stone. There was early speculation that these channels were to carry water. But a number of research investigators and also my associate, Jan-Peter De Jong, have seen it up close and taken photographs. And actually, Jan sent me a couple of photographs. The channels are for supporting cable, supporting tubes of some kind that he believes, and I now do believe, powered some instrumentation in that tower. The main photograph, and by the way, the title for this, it was posted July 28th, which is Thursday, last Thursday. The title is Ancient Tower at Sacsayhuaman. The main photograph is of this perfectly cut channel that carried wires, carried some kind of instrument, or excuse me, powered cord or wires or tubing into the central section of the tower. So, of course, you don't hear about this from traditional archaeologists because they don't speculate about that. They don't speculate about it at all because it's not in their training to think that a building that may be, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8,000 years or older would have any machinery, anything that is technologically based that we can think about relating to what we have today, technologically speaking. Computers, guidance systems, and so on. One of the other things that I bring up, and it's my belief, is that tower was actually significantly bigger than just a normal couple, you know, 20 feet, 10 feet, or whatever. My guess is actually 70 feet or taller. And there's a modified architectural rendering of the complex that you can take a look at in that gallery series. So take a look, see what you think. Let me know. You know, please, the thing that's the beauty of this is of Facebook is we like to have people comment and give us their opinions. Then we all kind of learn from each other's questions and answers. And that's important. That's what Facebook's all about. It's the epitome of social media, communication and discussion and, you know, thought. Thinking about these things. So do have a look. All right, so we move from South America to Egypt. Earlier this year, we spoke to John Anthony West about the Sphinx. And, of course, John went into Göbekli Tepe in Turkey. But today, we're going to focus on Egypt. Most people know that John Anthony West is famous for redating and discussing the Sphinx and the Giza Plateau. And Robert Schock also presented and spoke to us about the Sphinx enclosure, the megaliths that are around there, and how it dates much earlier than traditional Egyptologists would like us to believe, significantly earlier. Their discussions, you know, again, focused on the buildings, the Sphinx, the enclosure, and some of the surrounding structures that were engineered and designed by a very sophisticated advanced culture. A follow-up to them would be Christopher Dunn. Now, Chris Dunn wrote a book called The Giza Power Plant, and his most recent book, Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, covers a great deal about the actual construction techniques or machining techniques of the boulders, of the sculptures, and the standing stones, the megaliths that are throughout ancient Egypt. And what's fascinating about Dunn and why you don't hear about it a great deal in mainstream archaeology is that he blows the top off of the general theory that megaliths and the buildings were carved and erected using copper chisels and mallets. He has shown that power tools were involved. He is an expert, tools expert, engineer, and his book, again, the book, you should get it, it's called Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, goes into the craftsmanship and the mechanical devices that may have been employed to create these massive sculptures in the buildings. Now, we don't have any reference at all to the actual machines because there's nothing that's been found that is a machine or a device to cut into these stones. What's left to us is the reference point, the cutting marks of these tools. Egyptologists don't talk about it because they don't understand that. And if they admit that there's power tools involved in cutting, shaping of stones, erecting 1,000-ton obelisks and sculptures using mechanical devices, it blows their theories of an archaic society out the window. So that is an amazing bit of eye-opening exploration in his book. By the way, the introduction of Chris Dunn's book, Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt, is written by Arlen Andrews, who is a mechanical engineer and will be our guest next week to discuss ancient technology. I hope you'll join us for that. But today, my guest is a gentleman who spent quite a bit of time in Egypt and actually chronicles these amazing, advanced, engineered, and technological, I call it residue. And residue is systems, blocks, and he's going to tell us a little bit about what he discovered in Giza, at the Giza Plateau in Egypt. My guest today is Jarrett Gardner. He's a former military journalist who got involved in pyramid research at a young age. Actually, he was 23 when he took a trip to the Giza Plateau. Since that time, he's been to Egypt four times and logged more than 2 months in the country doing research, compiling his investigations. He's written two books. His first book was What Egyptologists Don't Want You to See. Actually, the second book has the same title, so it's Volume 1 and Volume 2. He chronicles evidence of high technology. I'm having Jarrett on because I've read both the books. The first book is kind of an eye-opener because he actually has photographs and shows the evidence of the technology. But the second book goes into something completely different. We'll talk about that in a minute. Now, Jarrett's coming to us today from Japan, where he lives with his wife and family. And he is, he teaches English, I guess, and writing. And so welcome to the program, Jarrett. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks, Cliff.
Okay, great. So tell us a little bit about your interest in the ruins. Of course, you went there, and I don't know if it was on vacation or you were stationed there as a journalist for the military or you were close by, but tell us what got you there, what started your interest in those ruins?
I guess back in 1997, I was doing some freelance journalism work for just a local local magazine called Revolt in Style. This is when I lived in San Diego. So I took I was going to write an article about what was called the UFO Congress, which was in Laughlin, Nevada. So I took booked my hotel and took a bus trip out there. And during the course of that presentation, I ended up meeting a gentleman by the name of Larry Hunter, who had done, at that time, I think 25 years of research into the Great Pyramids. And he had a total different theory that I had never heard before at all. And he was one of the few speakers there that actually had any evidence to support what he was saying. And during the course of our conversations, I ended up getting hired as a videographer to go over there and work with his nonprofit research organization. And so that was my first trip in 97. And we subsequently went back in 1998. After that, I did not work for the research team anymore. I went back in the year 2000 by myself. And later, I joined the military as a journalist, and I did my time there. And when I got out, I met my wife in Japan, and so I moved back over here. Well, in 2009, I had the idea of going back for a 30-day research expedition. I was going to take my camera. I was going to do what I normally would do in the Navy, but I was going to basically go over and see these individuals, Mr. Hunter included, Joseph Davidovits, who has the geopolymer theory. Christopher Dunn, you mentioned him. I was basically going to go over there and see if the evidence is actually there. I had seen some photographs on websites and stuff like that, but at the time, I didn't really know too much about it. And so the whole goal was to go over there and find out if the evidence was really there, and if it wasn't, you know, why not, and, you know.
And when you say evidence, you're saying evidence of high technology. You wanted to see what these other authors, researchers had were talking about. Is that what you're referring
to? Right. For example, Joseph Davidovits has a theory that they were basically a poured stone, a poured concrete into a mold. So that would be the pyramid, the blocks of the Great Pyramid. Right. And then there's Christopher Dunn, who has he actually has evidence that shows that there's, like you pointed out, electronic machining. So I was trying to, you know, amalgamate the two, like, how could they both be correct? And so I needed to go over there and, you know, see for myself what was really going on and hopefully take some photos of it. And what I ended up finding out was that in regards to the basalt blocks, which there's a basalt block foundation, which is at the base of the Great Pyramid, and it's on the limestone foundation. And the saw marks, there's saw marks and no core drill marks, just saw marks in this location. But these were first discovered by Flinders Petrie back in 1890, right. And then they were re-chronicled by Christopher Dunn. So when I went there, I found the saw marks that were there, and in Petrie's words, he says that this proves that they were all sawn and fitted together. And at first I thought he was correct, because I was seeing saw marks all over the place as well. I mean, I got the photos in, I think it's volume one, where I show you know, multiple examples of this. Well, what I also noticed was, even though the saw marks were quite prevalent all over the place, in some cases, the blocks already had a flat surface, but it was a slightly bumpy texture, and then they used the saw to trim part of it off. And it was actually quite hard to find a block that had, you know, more than two sides that were sawn through. So Joseph Davidovits would have said probably that, you know, these blocks were, because he's poured granite, he's poured basalt, he's poured diorite in his laboratory back in France. So I would imagine he would say that these were, you know, poured and cast and then possibly hardened and then trimmed with a saw. So, you know, that's just talking about the basalt blocks in front of the Great Pyramid. You know, it's a little bit different when you go to the core blocks. Each set of construction, you need to look at it with a new set of eyes and sort of dissect it.
Well, does he believe that the entire Great Pyramid is poured concrete blocks, or because there's some huge megalithic size some of those interior blocks weigh excess of 100 tons.
A lot of the writers would, you know, each individual writer would like to sort of, you know, push their idea. So I don't know exactly if he believes they're 100% all poured. It comes out that way in his reading, in his books. Mm-hmm. But when you go there and you see the Great Pyramid, first of all, if you look at the second Great Pyramid, you notice right away that they've cut the foundation down to level it out by about, 3 to 4 meters. So there's a big section of land that was, the amount of work that was put into that alone is amazing. So
those blocks were
harvested. There's even a section that still remains where you can see where they almost went down another level, but they stopped for some reason. So those blocks were harvested out of there, but whether or not they were harvested out in chunks and then re-put into a cement mix, I don't know. I would imagine that they were harvested as blocks and then utilized in the pyramid. But I have seen, and I got the photographs again in the book, where you look at a core block, for example, this one in particular, the corner was lower than, one of the corners was lower than the other four, and it had a wavy sort of texture to it, like it was incredibly wet and almost like it was poured into a mold, but they didn't fill it all the way to the top. They missed this section of the corner, and it sort of settled in this wavy pattern. And then the next tier up, noticing their mistake, they packed a whole bunch of the same quality of limestone cement, basically, but in this case it would be used as a mortar to patch that corner, and then they placed, either placed the block on top of that or poured another block on top of that.
Interesting.
So it's quite,
well, let's talk about, yeah, let's quite talk about your, go ahead.
It's quite confusing when you look at it. You got to really, this guy will say they're all poured, perhaps. This guy will say, they were cut and sawn, perhaps. When you get there, you see it's kind of maybe both activities were going on.
So they did a little bit of both. Yeah.
In my opinion, yes. The evidence is quite clear on that.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about Volume 1. You pay a lot of attention to the weathering of the stoneworks, and I think that gets into the age. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your findings of the weathering of the stones and what your feeling is on the actual causation of that weathering, and give us some, if you can, give us your hypothesis for what the dates would be for that.
Okay, yeah. The work you're mentioning right now is an Egyptian Egyptologist named, not Egyptologist, sorry, Egyptian researcher named Sharif El Morsi. And he recently photographed, I think it was 2010, he photographed what is basically tidal erosion patterns on the casing blocks of the Second Great Pyramid and other places around the plateau as well. But the significance of being on the outer layer of the Second Great Pyramid suggests that there was some sort of ancient flood of some kind. And the particular type of tidal erosion is called Tofoni pitting. If you don't know what that is, I guess you can Google it and you'll see what that looks like. But so that's his work. And, right now, what's popular, you mentioned earlier Dr. Robert Schock and John Anthony West and their redating of the Sphinx, which Dr. Robert Schock is a little conservative, I believe. He says about 7,000 years old as opposed to around 4,000 years old. And John Anthony West is a little bit more liberal with his dating, about 10 or 15, I believe. Right now, the year 10,000 is quite popular because of Göbekli Tepe and the recent discoveries over there. In my research of trying to figure out when could a flood have occurred to cause this amount of Tofoni pitting or tidal erosion patterns, I came across I can't remember exactly, but I think there's about 15 floods that occurred as far back as 20,000 years ago to 10,000 years ago at the end of the last ice age. And these were due to ice dam failures. So whether or not these would have caused a long-lasting flood, because this, according to Sharif El Morsi, the depth of the Tofoni pitting plus the amount of block material loss can be measured, and the density of the stone itself can be calculated. And according to him, there's centuries of erosion on the casing blocks, which are a really dense limestone. So whatever flood occurred, it would have had to have been a very long-lasting one. So whether or not it happened, you know, in the period of 20,000 to 10,000 years ago, I can't say for sure. He does have photographic evidence of echinoid. It's basically a sea urchin, a type of sea urchin, and it's photographed on top of the Third Great Pyramid Temple block, one of the uppermost blocks in the Third Great Pyramid Temple.
How high up is that?
It's about 15 feet.
Okay.
So it's flush on top of the flat surface of this block, and it's fossilized, and the exoskeleton is petrified. The inside has been filled with alluvial sediment deposits. You know, it's basically turned to limestone itself, and the block is limestone. So when you're trying to, you know, dissect what was moving with the flood and what was original material, it's a little bit tricky, but you can see that there's a definite flat surface on this block, and it's a little bit bumpy around it. And according to Sharif al-Morsi, this bumpy stuff is part of the alluvial sediment deposits that's basically, for all intents and purposes, a limestone mud that kind of moved up on there due to the sea. And then when the seas receded, it hardened to the block as well, and this sea creature wound itself up there as well, flush on top of this flat surface. Now, the debunkers are looking at it and saying, well, you know, that's obviously impossible. This creature, I tried to find it in a fossil classification book, and it closely resembles a few fossils, and to be honest, they date in the millions of years, so I don't, you know where to go with that, but I mean, it's obviously, it could be a misclassification on my part, but...
Okay, so there, so you're saying that that is a sea creature that is identified as a millions of years, as have lived in millions of years?
Well, I found, okay. I got, to try and figure this out, I bought two books. One of them was the Encyclopedia of Fossils, and the other one is something similar. Basically, it's a guidebook to try and classify something if you find it. So I'm not an expert in fossils by any means. I'm not a paleontologist. I'm just, you know, I got a background in journalism. I was just trying to do my own research on the matter. And the ones that I was finding in the book were dating to this range. And I'm not saying that that is the case, but the thing is petrified. It is fossilized, and I'm not exactly sure how long that it takes for that to happen.
I guess my question is there more than one of these sea creatures that's embedded? Is there like a grouping of them? Is there evidence of other sea creatures that were embedded in this stonework?
Yes, and it's quite common, and they've been found in geologists would say is that this was part of the stone and it eroded and it revealed itself. But in this case, with this one particular one, it's obviously flat on this flat surface on, you know, 15 feet up on top of this block, and there's some extra alluvial sediment stuck to the block as well. The other ones, to the, you know, geologist's credit, they are in areas which look like they have been eroded and revealed. But in some of the cases, if you look closely, like if you can imagine a swath of erosion, it makes a curve cut out of the block. Do you follow me on that?
Yeah, the erosion, the water hitting the stone. I think Schock talks about that in the Sphinx enclosure, about how the erosion is evidence for age.
Right. In my book, I have one photo of these... same type of seashell creature. It's basically a type of sea urchin, like I said. Well, on this particular, this is one of the mastabas that's on the east side of the Great Pyramid. And the flat surface has been eroded, so there's a big curved swath taken out of it laterally. And on the swath are two of these creatures. Now, they're within the swath, so it does first appear that, okay, this was eroded, and then these were revealed. But it doesn't make sense why they're still there, and they are not eroded, they were not cut into, and when you look at it closely, you see one of them follows the contour exactly, like the contour was already there, and this creature came up and stuck to the contour, and then the other one follows the contour exactly as well, and stuck to the lower contour. So you have one that's stuck to the lower contour, and one that's stuck to the other contour, the upper contour. And so you can look at it two ways. Maybe it was revealed, and it just happens to be coincidentally that one follows the upper contour and one follows the lower contour, or that the swath was cut due to the flood, and then sometime after that, these two creatures made their way there and stuck themselves there for whatever reason other than the flat surface on the other side.
Right.
So it's fine.
Yeah. But you're talking about tidal erosion, right? So you're talking about the undulating flow of tidal hitting up against a megalithic block, rather than water with shock, which is water flowing down and cascading over the enclosure to create this deep groove. So your theory is that the flooding actually came right up to the Great Pyramid, right? Tell us a little bit about that theory that you have.
Right. This is the work of Sharif El-Morsi, like I said, but this would predate what Dr. Robert Schock and John Anthony West were talking about. And, you know, to their credit, what they said is true. There is a lot of rain erosion there. I'm sure you've seen it. I'm sure your fans have seen it. But, Sharif El-Morsi's work is somewhat recent, and it would predate whatever the rain erosion was. And so the idea is, or the goal is, to try and depict a time frame of when that could have happened. And it would have had to have been a long-lasting flood where it's basically, from the evidence that is supplied by Sharif El-Morsi and that I have seen on the plateau as well, the water could have went completely around the Great Pyramids. It went around the backside of the Second Great Pyramid. I said earlier that the Second Great Pyramid, has the foundation had been cut down, and there's basically essentially a cliff that goes around the perimeter of the Second Great Pyramid. Well, the water moved its way around there, and that's where you find some of the Tifoni pitting on the casing blocks. And then you see it on the temples as well, the Second Great Pyramid Temple and the Third Great Pyramid Temple. And what's interesting is the Second Great Pyramid Temple has more water erosion than, more tidal erosion than the Third Great Pyramid. And according to Morsi, the tide would have came in from the north and up the Nile, basically overflowing the Nile during high tide, and would have surpassed the Second Great Pyramid Temple, and then finally reaching the Third Great Pyramid Temple to the south. And when it receded, the Third Great Pyramid Temple would be exposed first, and then the Second Great Pyramid Temple would still be underwater at this time. So what I'm trying to say is the Second Great Pyramid Temple would receive about twice as much erosion as, you know, from the tide in this
because of the receding water. Getting hit harder.
Right. That's exactly what you see. The block material loss on the Second Great Pyramid Temple is about twice as much as the Third Great Pyramid Temple.
Okay. What do you think, what is the estimated date for this flooding indication of erosion?
You know, really, I've done some research into it, and it, according to mainstream scientists, there was a major, I wrote about it in my book, but I'm having trouble recalling right now, but there was a time when the whole Mediterranean was full, and it flooded, and came in to where the Great Pyramids are now. Whether or not the Great Pyramids were there at that time, that's the big question. So that area has flooded several times, according to mainstream scientists. But if I remember correctly, it's 50,000 years ago or something like that. There's been several big major floods, but the dating is far back in time. So
yeah. 50,000 years ago is fairly significant.
Right.
Yeah.
There's even a flood that happened in that region even before that, which, you know, the human species is about 200,000 years ago. So you go too far back and you're already out of the ballpark of the human race. But so it all depends on, you know, what you're open to. And really, you know, there needs to be some other experts who need to come in. Like I said, I'm coming in from a journalistic background, and I can say that, you know, I've seen these fossils on the blocks. I've seen the erosion here. The experts that are doing the research really got to stand on their own 2 feet, like Sharif El-Morsi. I've seen his work. I've studied his work. I found it to be true. I've taken the photographs, and I've showed it in my book. And people can, you know, read the book and see for themselves and make a judgment for themselves, basically. It's really hard to make a date. I tend to avoid it because, you know, you could say millions of years ago and you'll turn a lot of people off. You could say 10,000 years ago and you might have a lot of fans, but that might not be, you know, correct. I mean, I think it was Zachariah Sitchin who was saying possibly 200,000 years ago, but again, that's supposed to be at the beginning of the, you know, Homo sapiens sapiens. So
yeah.
I tend to avoid that at all costs, but I'm open-minded to, you know, hey, if the evidence pops up and, you know, this says that potentially this fossil is this old, okay, we're looking for a flood that is around that time.
Mm-hmm.
So that's,
well,
you know,
we do know that we know that the ancient cultures like Egyptians and the ancient Egyptians and the Maya built over earlier construction. So
right, exactly.
Perhaps the megalithic builders in Egypt who built those massive stones and somehow transported them from miles away were are significantly older, are 50,000 years or older. And they are the foundation builders. And then there was another group who may have been more mechanically inclined to use power tools to cut and shape and form the pyramids, the pyramid buildings to support the pyramids and the surrounding structures. So who knows? That's the thing.
Right.
We don't have any records of this. But I'm interested because I want you to tell us a little bit about a section in your book that you discuss what you discovered in the mechanical features and the buildings, the pyramids,
right,
that may suggest that they were built for some industrial function. Tell us what your theory is on that and how you base that, what you've discovered. And this is from Volume 1.
Volume 2, I think, is what you're talking about. Chapter 1, Volume 2?
Volume
anyway.
1 is what I got that.
Okay, I'll go into it, and you can maybe correct me if I'm on the wrong track. But what people need to understand is, what I've come to understand is, I mean, you say ancient Egyptians, and everybody thinks of basically the Egyptians. And, you know, for example, Pharaoh Khufu or any of the other number of, you know, Egyptology stated kings of that time. But what it looks like is, I mean, with the evidence of the flood, if we're going to take that as being a possibility, then we got to say to ourselves, okay, well, the Great Pyramid was here during a period of massive flooding. So therefore, the ancient Egyptians that we know, we're basically just picking up the pieces of this ancient civilization, possibly picking up the language as well, and they might have been the first people to decipher the hieroglyphics before Jean-Francois Champollion. So that is the perspective that I have to look at as well. If we were to take all the pieces, all the evidence that we see, and try and formulate, you know, potential possibilities. Well, one of the first guys I worked with, which I mentioned him earlier, was Mr. Hunter. He had a patent, basically, for a solar power reflector and collector device. And his patent was it's two parts. There was a primary reflector and then a set of four secondary reflectors. And the primary reflector was a pyramid shape, and each side of the pyramid was concaved in such a way that it indented 1 meter, and it was not a curved concave, but more faceted. Like, each side of the Great Pyramid was made up of about five facets, which would indent mm-hmm. about 1 meter. And this actually is the exact geometry of the Great Pyramid. This was discovered discovered by Petrie in 1880, 1890. Actually, before that, Napoleon's team, I should say, discovered the corner casing block sockets, which didn't match up with the external casing blocks on the north side of the Great Pyramid. So, mm-hmm. basically, there was a 1 meter indent on the side of the Great Pyramid. And the second Great Pyramid doesn't have this. The third Great Pyramid doesn't have this. It's a straight line there from cornerstone to cornerstone all the way along the edge. It's a straight line. But the Great Pyramid, for some reason, has a parallel line of casing blocks at the center, and then the corner casing blocks are extended 1 meter out on all four sides. So there was another group of individuals, David Davidson and H. Aldersmith in 1920. These guys were called pyramidologists, and they weren't taken very seriously because they believed the Great Pyramid was constructed by the hand of God and some other, you know, whatever you want to make of that. But what was interesting was they were able to reconcile the measurements that Petrie made, and they came up with this design of what the casing blocks would have looked like with the indenture, with the concave feature, with the facets right. of five panels. And to them, they noticed right away that with the white limestone, which was chosen specifically for the Great Pyramid, which is a whiter limestone than the core blocks. The core blocks are more of a yellow color. And the outer casing blocks are really dense, fossil-free, for the most part, really hard white limestone. What they realized right away is that the sunlight reflections off of this came to focal points off out in the desert, off of each of the four sides. So it basically acted as a parabolic lens. Each one of the four sides of the Great Pyramid acted like a parabolic lens. So to them, this was evidence that the Great Pyramid was basically like a sundial city. Like Big Ben is in the middle of London today. Their idea was the Great Pyramid was a giant sundial, which would, you know, reflect the sunlight off of all four sides of the Great Pyramid to focal points out in the desert. And anybody from anywhere around the village or city would be able to tell what time it is or what season it is or et cetera. Well, to Mr. Hunter, to Mr. Hunter, it was a sign of something much more, which was leads into his patent, which was for a solar reflector and collector device.
The pyramid was, in his estimation, the pyramid was a giant solar reflection, a reflector? I haven't heard that one. Okay.
Well, other people have said that, you know, it could have reflected microwaves during the nighttime. But for me, part of his evidence is the white limestone that was chosen. And this was the reflections off of this was noticed, I guess, like I said, by David Davidson and H. Aldersmith. So he just he got the idea that perhaps the Great Pyramid was a solar reflector and collector device. So he decided to make a patent based off that. And I think I sent you some photographs of, one of them is a solar farm that we have today, which there's one that I visited actually called Solar One, which is out in Barstow, and this was back in 1998, but basically it's an array of mirrors that surround a tower. And I think we've all seen either movies or something like that where the sunlight reflects off the mirrors, and then the focal point is at the top of the tower where they basically heat molten salt to store under the ground so they can generate steam turbines at nighttime to generate electricity. Well, in Hunter's idea, the Great Pyramid would be the primary reflector. So the sunlight hits all four sides of the Great Pyramid, reflects off of those four sides to four separate focal points because of this concave geometry. And those focal points, and this is where it switches to his patent, because it's a little difficult to try and, in his words, to try and figure out with the relics that are at the plateau right now how they would have been able to direct, you know, redirect the sunlight. But in his patent, he uses four secondary reflectors to catch that focal point and then reflect that light back to the apex of the Great Pyramid. So it's a similar design as what we're using today. You know, whether or not it was actually used for that, you know, I don't know.
Could have been another use for it other than what we think, because Chris Dunn believes that there was a chemical reaction that took place inside the Great Pyramid and that it was an actual power plant. But what you're suggesting could be a secondary use.
Exactly. I've read Christopher Dunn's first book like about three times, so I had to just to follow it all the way through, because I did write a chapter about him, but it didn't make it into my book. But I think this is just another layer to the onion. So I think whatever was going on inside the Great Pyramid, you know, I could not find fault with Christopher Dunn's work, with the exception of he has a few missing parts, but that, you know, that's understandable considering how much time has gone on. You know, he has some hypothetical heating and cooling tower in the Queen's Chamber, and then he has some sort of missing crystal amplifier inside the King's Chamber. You know, so, but besides that, I found absolutely no fault in his idea. This is, to me, this is on the outside. It's another layer to the onion, potentially. I did have a Facebook conversation with a group of individuals, and one guy suggested that perhaps the indentation was to make the side appear flat, like the Greeks did with the Parthenon. The Parthenon is actually concave slightly, which is, you know, a valid point. But in the case of the Parthenon, the curve is actually a curve. In the case of the Great Pyramid, it's a straight indent, and then a flat line, and then another indent going out to the corner. So it's more like facets that are put together. And it's noticeable. So when you stand at one end to the other, it doesn't make the side of the Great Pyramid look flat at all. It makes it, you can see that it's indented versus the other pyramids, which don't have this geometry built into them. So this is major. Like if you can, you said maybe Christopher Dunn's coming on your show next week?
Another engineer, Arlen Andrews, who has studied these things and actually has written extensively in a number of publications. So
This would be a good question for, if you were to ask him, what's the difference between making a flat-sided pyramid and making a faceted pyramid, each side indented with five faceted triangles, what's the difference in engineering? And I'm quite sure he would say that it's night and day. You know, the flat side pyramid would be much easier to do. And like I said, the Great Pyramid is the only pyramid that has this indented geometry. It's been mentioned in numerous periodicals and movies. But it's never been answered.
I want to remind our audience that you can call us and speak directly to Jarrett. The guest line is area code 347. 826-9565. That's 347-826-9565. And we'll take your call, and you can ask Jared a question. You have a chapter in your new book, the volume two of what archaeologists don't want to tell you, show you, excuse me. It's called, the chapter is called Modern Machine Shop Tolerance Levels Discovered in the Ancient Stone Cut Boxes of the Serpium. Can you tell us a little bit about what you've discovered? Because that is something that has been recently discussed in a number of magazines and a couple of books. And those boxes are literally huge blocks of granite that have been expertly cut. So tell us what you discovered about those.
Right. Yeah, they're very popular on some Facebook threads I've seen recently. And unfortunately, when I was there in 2009, the whole area was closed for restoration, so I didn't get a chance to go in there. But I wrote the chapter anyway because it pertains to the Saqqara area, which was another chapter in the book. And these blocks, these are basically stone boxes. I don't recall how many there are. I mean, about 40, perhaps. And they're in a giant underground cavern, basically. And each one has its own niche, and each one has its own corresponding lid. And these things are just absolutely massive. To give you an idea of the size of one of these is some of them are bigger than a Volkswagen bus.
And yeah,
they're about, you know, 1 foot thick in some areas. And the lid itself is looks to be about a foot and a half thick. So the weight, I would, you know, according to what I know as the granite blocks in the King's Chamber of the Great Pyramid, the heaviest of which weigh about 70 tons, based off an estimate off of that, I would say, since they're hollowed out and they are boxes, perhaps they're around 70 to 100 tons. The raw material for that, I mean, before it was hollowed out, the raw material for that, you know, you could easily double, you know, just for an estimate.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
And where were they quarried? Do we know where they were quarried and brought in? Because you figure a 70 to 100 ton block of solid granite would really, and they're not even on the surface. They're under, they're what, 20, 30 feet underground in a special chamber, right?
Right. There are a lot
I wonder how they got those down there.
That's another, you know, mystery. And in the chapter I wrote, you know, I think, I don't know if I mentioned it, but Christopher Dunn had mentioned, I think in an interview about it, that they must have been, like, made in place, because to make them so perfect, he's tested them with his engineering tools, and he's put, you know, an engineering, I don't know the name of the tool, actually, but it's basically a corner.
Yeah,
level.
It's an angle.
And
it's an angle that
right
measures
angle,
the surface
right.
flatness. Yeah.
Right. And he's gone in there and mentioned and placed it up in the corner and shined light through it to see if any light goes through. And that's a rough test of the basic flatness of the surface. And everywhere he checked, you know, light did not shine through. And this is his engineering, it's square is what it's called, actually. This is his engineering square that he bought. And it's something, you know, it's not the typical one you would get at a hardware store. So this is like a perfect square. And
yeah, it has
so
amazingly tight tolerances, apparently.
Right, it's an engineering square. It's not something you get at Home Depot or something like that. So everywhere he checked, you know, the light did not shine through. And he said that in this interview, I believe, if you were to make these off-site and then transport them into this area where the humidity was there, that potentially that they would warp and or just, you know, not the perfectness would just not be there anymore. So you would risk, you know, putting that at risk. So, you know, I don't know. The granite, if it's if it's from Aswan, which is where they say all the granite, you know, the Egyptologists say all the granite came from, which is the closest place to get granite, would be 500 miles south in Aswan. And so, you know, that's where it would have to come from. And I went there back in 2009, and it's got quite a bit of granite missing from that location, but I didn't see any places where large blocks were taken out, you know. But, you know, if it's granite, it should have come from there, because that's the closest granite quarry. But, yeah, how they would move... See, this is where you got to set yourself apart from the ancient Egyptians, which did not have this technology. They had copper chisels, wooden mallets. They had... basically, that's it. So, to transport, you know, something that's potentially 150 tons of raw material, 500 miles up the Nile, that's quite a engineering feat for a primitive Egyptian.
And what else did you find was unique about these stone sarcophaguses or whatever they were? What was the theory of their use, and for placing them so deep under the underground? What's the theory behind that?
This is personally me. I have a hunch that these might have been put there by the Egyptians. How, I don't know. They might have been in the local area, or they might have been, you know, there, and they sort of, it looks like this underground cavern is potentially made over it. There's arches. So they could have been in this general vicinity, and they buried them. As to whoever made them and what they were used for, the Egyptologists say that they were to bury mummified cows, but they haven't found any. You know, as usual, the mummies were not found. There's no cow parts or cow anything to do with cows, you know, found in there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, if we're going to branch off to Christopher Dunn's theory that, you know, the granite box in the King's Chamber was housed some sort of crystal amplifier, I would say that, you know, these were part of some system, and they had something inside there that was, you know, necessary to the system. But, you know, what that could have been, I don't know.
Is there any residue, crystallization of some chemicals or anything that would show that maybe these boxes were housings for some equipment?
There was a report, I forget his first name, but it's Mariette, and he was one of the early Egyptologists. His statue is at the Cairo Museum right now, and he's the guy that discovered that. And there was a report that he found some sort of tar residue. What that tar was made of, you know, it's, I don't know, but some sort of, you know, petroleum product. But that's all I came across in the research of it.
Okay, interesting.
And that was just in one of them, yeah.
Just one of them. We're getting down to the hour here. Can you tell us, give us kind of a synopsis of your most recent work and what you find is the most significant discovery on the Giza Plateau, because that's pretty much where you focus, is the plateau and the surrounding areas. Given the fact that we know there was an advanced society, maybe multiple societies that lived continually in that area, the earliest being sophisticated enough to move megaliths into place with such precision we can't even duplicate it today. The next group may be living several thousand years later, having a technology that powered machines. And then the preceding civilizations were, that they appear to be the survivors from some cataclysm, and their repair work of these magnificent structures is pathetic. They use mud block bricks to shimmy up and to try to support
right.
a lot of these earlier properties. But tell us a little bit about what you find is not only compelling evidence of an advanced culture, but what are you left with? Give us some final thoughts about your books.
Well, that's why in Volume 1, I started off with Sharif El-Morsi's work, and that's the tidal erosion. And along the way, each chapter kind of, I don't want to, like, in the book, I didn't want to say, you know, I think this is the way it is, da-da-da. You know, I'm coming from a journalistic background, like I said, so I'm kind of painting a picture as it goes along. But from what I see and from what I've found, all evidence suggests that there was a pre-flood civilization that was highly technologically advanced. They could pour concrete, stone concrete, potentially all kinds of stone. They could drill and saw, and some of these core drill holes are 8 inches in diameter or more. And this is in granite. So an 8-inch diameter core drill hole, you know, that's a massive undertaking that, you know, today would take a motor, you know, a huge motor to turn that. So
right.
this civilization, how far back this civilization goes, I don't know. Like I said, I've tried to find, you know, examples of when this flood occurred, you know, how many floods occurred. And so I can potentially say, okay, well, the pyramid was built sometime prior to this date, or the pyramid was built sometime prior to this date, and so on. Then, yes, in my mind, actually, there's also some evidence that the Great Pyramid was restored by a group of individuals that had the same technology. So potentially the same group of individuals had restored the Great Pyramid. There's a couple of photographs in Volume 1 where I show some, I think the chapter was called Restoration Work by the Original Builders or something along those lines. And so there is evidence that the original builders restored their own work, you know, prior to the destruction and the flood. And
okay.
then you have the destruction and the flood, and then you have the Egyptians coming in and picking up the broken pieces and, you know, taking the Ramses statue and moving it all the way over to Luxor and saying, I'm Ramses the Pharaoh. And you have Ramses I, Ramses II, Ramses III, Ramses IV. And and this is just the way it looks to me, that the Egyptians saw something good here and they're like, okay, we can work with this. And how far of a separation between what we call the ancient Egyptians and the original builders, I honestly have no idea. You know, we need more evidence to play with. There's the fossils, which are on the rocks. But like I said, you have to have such a close eye when you're looking at these things. So the geologists quite easily will say, oh, well, there's fossils all throughout the blocks because they were cut from the foundation. And they were, you know, the foundation is a fossilized ocean floor. Well, yes, that is true. And in some cases, they were cut from the foundation. It's evident. You can see next to the Great Pyramid, they cut the foundation down to level it. But in other cases, you look at these blocks, and they were poured limestone, just as Joseph Davidovits said. And it looks like they were poured into a mold. And I'm sure they weren't in every single case. He has some recent research where – it's not his, actually. It's a team from Cairo University, I believe. And they found a way to test the magnetic poles of the blocks so they could find out the north and south pole of the block. And this would tell them if the blocks were poured or not, because if the blocks are poured, they're all going to have the same north and south pole. Well, what they found is 9 times out of 10 they had the same magnetic pole, and this was posted on Joseph Davidovits' website. So this was further evidence in support of his theory, and this was fairly recent. So, but they said there was an occasional time where the block, the north and south pole, did not match. It was running east-west, whereas opposed to north-south. So that would suggest that this block was not poured in situ, that it might have been poured somewhere nearby, hardened, and then moved there, or it might have been cut from the foundation, as a geologist would say, and then placed there. So you have to have a firm grasp of all these theories of all these individuals, and then go there with this in mind, and you really got to take your time when you look at this stuff. So,
yeah.
I don't know if that answers your question or not. But.
Well, no, I'm curious, because your first book has quite a bit on evidence of high technology, similar to what Chris
right.
Dunn shows, which is the massive stones, the megaliths
right.
that are cut.
The second book goes more
yeah.
into there's an alternative theory about the Great Pyramid, which I talked about, and then there's also the rest of my trip, basically, where I went to the different pyramid sites, which is Maidum, Dashur, the Bent Pyramid, and the Red Pyramid. I went to Abu Wizr, which is, there's several pyramids along that site, which is
right.
full of ancient technology, actually. And so
right.
I was trying to figure out, which pyramid is built first. They said this pyramid is built first, and I'm kind of going over to see, does that make sense? And this is according to the Egyptologists. And from what I could gather, it looks like there was a progression of construction. And pretty much starting like they say, there's the Maidum and then the Bent Pyramid and then the Red Pyramid. But they say the Step Pyramid of Djoser was built first, and that's kind of where I take a sidestep, and I don't really... I think that might have been one of the pyramids built by the Egyptians. And
mm-hmm.
underneath the Step Pyramid is actually a mastaba. So perhaps that mastaba was built by the original pyramid builders, and the Egyptians built over that. Because the Step Pyramid is actually two pyramids built over a mastaba. And the reason is that the pharaoh built the mastaba, then he wasn't happy. He got the idea to add another mastaba on top, and so on, and he came up with a Step Pyramid. And then he decided it wasn't big enough, so he built a bigger Step Pyramid over the original. So
wow. Yeah.
So the second book kind of goes into that.
Yeah. Yeah, and the title of these books is both Volume 1 and Volume 2, What Egyptologists Don't Want You to See. And my guest today has been Jarrett Gardner. Jarrett, are you going to be speaking anywhere? Or I'm going to post information on your website, which is called GizaNow.com. Can people get more information about you at GizaNow.com?
Right. They can. There's also a Giza Now Facebook group if they're interested. And I do have a book page, which is What Egyptologists Don't Want You to See. That's on Facebook as well.
Okay.
So
perfect.
But they can go to GizaNow.com. And on GizaNow.com, there's Chapter 1 of Volume 1. So they can read that and get some new information for themselves.
Okay.
And
Fascinating. Yeah. I guess you'll be going back to the Giza Plateau whenever you can, huh? I would think that
yeah.
you want to get back there and really see what's going on.
Yeah, I have plans in the works for a return trip, yeah.
Wow, fantastic. Thank you for joining us. That's been
you're welcome.
What an eye-opener. And I'll go ahead and post some photographs. And links to your Amazon page so people can download the book. What is it? What are you charging right now for the download? Is it how much is it? Do you know?
There's quite a few versions. So if you're getting the paperback, it's about $10. If you're getting the ebook, it's the same price, $10. But there's a high definition color version, which is split into two parts because the photos are such a high file size. But each one of those is $5 each, so it's the same price, $10.
Okay.
So
that's
volume one is $10. Right.
Okay. All right. So I'll make sure that I post that. Hey, thanks again. Appreciate it. And
we look
forward to more great work with your discoveries. As a reminder, next week my guest is Arlen Andrews. Arlen is a... professional engineer, former technical staff member of the Bell Laboratories, and he is reveals quite a bit of information regarding advanced technology in South America, Central America, and he, along with Chris Dunn and a research team a few years ago, made some startling discoveries. He'll be my guest. I'll post more information about that. And join us next week for that program. That's it for today. I hope you have a great weekend, and we will see you next week.